Please be seated.
Commissioners, have you got any questions for Council? Any questions for Mr.
No, thank you.
Mr. Page, any questions?
Yes, Mr. Page, I do have a couple of questions. I just want to explore with you a little this controlled activity status and what in reality it might mean. So, say the controlled activity status became operative, perhaps along the procedural lines that's now being proposed, perhaps in some other form. Probably doesn't matter for the purposes of my hypothetical question. So if people decide that they want to say to the council, well, look, we might have applied for this way back when, but now we want this dealt with in terms of the controlled activities status. Is that how you envisage that might happen? I'm going to come on to the consequences in terms of 124 of that course of action in a minute, but I'm just trying to understand how you might see that being done.
Yes. Well, at the present time, of course, the activity status under Section 88 is fixed at the date of the application. And so if the controlled activity rule becomes operative and then the applicant decides that it wishes to follow that pathway, then the question arises, well, what is the procedural step that the applicant has to take to signal that and have the application processed as a controlled activity? I was, at the start of this hearing, of the view that there would need to be an application under the controlled activity lodged to enable that to happen. My friends, one of them, I can't remember which one, has made submissions suggesting that that's not the legal position. And if that's correct, then I'm content to accept that. There's no disadvantage in, with no advantage in arguing about that. But an election would have to be made somehow as to which route to follow and whether the application, which is currently before the council, meets the fourth schedule obligations of an applicant in relation to the change in status.
Right, so an election would need to be made. Who would you see making that election then?
It would have to be the applicant.
It would have to be the applicant, so that's what the applicant might do. So
yes,
the controlled activity rumbles along and it gets approved.
Yes.
So that effectively is involving the 124 continuation of exercise until a consent's granted, is it?
If the consent hasn't been granted prior to the expiry of the term of the consent being replaced, then yes, the applicant would be relying on section 124.
124, right. Okay. So it's not... So if they wanted to go on and bank their controlled activity, but they also wanted to continue on with a non-complying activity, they wouldn't have the protection application. They wouldn't have the protection of 124 anymore, or the benefits that go with 124.
Yes, I think that's right.
What is right? I don't actually agree with this line of this question, but so what do you think is right?
As I understand what the Commissioner is putting to me, so the applicant lodges a controlled activity application to be processed concurrent with a non-complying one. The controlled is granted. Can the non-complying activity... can the applicant continue then to rely on the section 124 right, notwithstanding that they have a controlled activity consent in hand? My view would be no, because what they are relying on in that interim period isn't 124 anymore, it's the controlled activity permit that's been granted, because it's the replacement for the earlier consent And so that, so then the, if the non-complying activity application is still on foot, it would fall to be decided on whatever the regime is at the time.
As a new application.
As a new application. Yeah. And so it's a substitution rather than a replacement, if that makes sense.
Yeah, the new application for a non-complying activity would, what is it, substitute the controlled activity which had been granted in the meantime, but as a fresh, brand new application.
Yep.
So 124 wouldn't apply to it?
No, I don't think so.
No,
I
just wanted to be clear about that, Mr. Page.
I have to say that I'm dealing with this on the hoof because I'd never contemplated that there would be two live applications on foot at the same time, that the applicant would have to elect which path they were pursuing. Yeah, Ms. Irving has just raised with me the way that the non-complying activity rule is currently framed. It's for a replacement of the deemed of the permit that's expiring, not as a replacement for a controlled activity that's already been granted. So I'm unclear that the non-complying activity pathway would still be available if you had a controlled activity consent in hand. That's to do with the way that the
drafting
conditions
of
have been drafted.
Drafted. Yes. Yeah. If you could just bear with me a moment, I'll just check whether there was anything else. I don't have anything else. Mr. Page, thank you.
Thank you.
You've heard plenty enough from me during the course of your submissions, so thank you for those. And now I think we're interposing another witness in your case.
Yes, I think we're hearing from Mr. Ensor.
We are. Okay, sorry about that. Ms. Dixon.
I do.
Mr. Ensor, do you confirm that your full name is Timothy Alistair Deans Ensor?
I do.
And you are a principal planner with Tonkin and Taylor Limited?
Correct.
You have filed, do you confirm you filed two briefs of evidence, a statement of evidence in chief dated the 5th of February 2021 and a supplementary statement of evidence dated the 18th of March 2021?
That is correct.
And will you confirm that you hold the qualifications and experience which are set out in paragraphs 7 to 9 of your evidence in chief?
I do.
Are there any corrections that you need to make to either of your briefs of evidence?
No.
Okay. Do you confirm that your evidence is true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
I do.
Thank you. Mr. Ensor, you provided a single-page summary at the beginning, or a two-page summary, actually, at the beginning of your evidence in chief, and, of course, have since filed the supplementary statement. So you can either read your summary to the court or, if you like, simply speak to the summary and to your supplementary statement, if that would be more appropriate.
If it's helpful for the court, I will talk to my summary, given that some matters have moved on, but I can...
Given that the summary has moved on?
Given that that I have a summary... that I have a supplementary brief of evidence as well.
Well, I'm quite happy that you talk. I guess the important thing is that you communicate quite clearly what are the key elements that you're wanting the court to understand from your evidence. Yep.
So with reference to the summary in my evidence in chief, It's probably best if I start below paragraph 3, so 3.1, which is where the relief sought is described. So in terms of the relief sought and in terms of matters I've explored in my evidence, this is still to achieve the objective of Plan Change 7 by strengthening the non-complying pathway, further encouraging the use of the controlled activity consenting pathway, and preserve existing hydrology that will be impacted by the loss of deemed permit priority. And just to add to that, based on evidence heard yesterday, all that would not be provided for by a flow limit or sharing regime.
So preserve the existing hydrology which will be impacted by loss of deemed permit priority that would not otherwise be provided for by loss through can you say it again?
By a flow limit or and sharing regime.
And I take it you mean deliberately flow limit is different from a flow sharing regime, and you can come back to us and later and say what's the difference.
Yes.
Yep.
And so in terms of solutions and strengthening the non-complying activity pathway, I've proposed amendments to policy 10A23 to remove the minor threshold, include elements of the MPSFM, particularly the first priority, under Te Mana or Te Wai, in order to preserve current hydrology and therefore ecosystem values. I've also proposed amendments to protect existing lawfully established water takes. And once again, in my evidence, I've discussed priority, but flow limit and sharing arrangements could also play a role in this. And the second part of this is amendments to the controlled activity consent pathway. And in terms of the philosophy put forward in my evidence in chief, it carries through to amendments that I've made in my supplementary evidence, and that is that the controlled activity pathway provides a simpler and more low-cost and therefore efficient pathway than as efficient as it can be. And in relation to early discussions by legal counsel for MFE, I've also suggested an additional policy supporting controlled activity applications being processed as such, if that rule was made operative early. But in my supplementary evidence, I haven't carried that through, so I've just let that sit.
Okay, what haven't you carried through?
The suggested additional policy that might support an immediately operative controlled.
Yes.
So that's
let's go out hard and early on the controlled activity rule, whilst not taking into account that many people actually want this plan to be rejected.
Correct.
Yep. And you're okay. Yep. So you're not carrying that through. Well, that's simpler. Yep.
Yep. So in terms of clarity around the relief sought in terms of specifics of drafting, starting with the controlled activity, and this is just now talking to my supplementary evidence and thoughts since yesterday. Mr. De Pelsmaker has made changes in his versions of PC7 attached to his supplementary evidence, which focus attention on procedural rather than environmental matters. And following questioning of Mr. De Pelsmaker by the court, I see that just striking out the matters of control and referring to conditions of current consents being defining the matters of control has the potential to broaden out the matters that might be considered by the council in a way that was unintended. The intention is that council's control is quite limited. And the other point raised was in relation to a shift from paper allocation to actual use or reasonable use. And I've suggested that Mr. De Palsmaker has changed there to focus the matter of control on that historic use more deliberately as a useful addition. Now, there's just one other point that I'd like to discuss in relation to the controlled activity rule. The matters of control in terms of Mr. De Palsmaker's suggestions, and that's in relation to his B, matter of control B, which was previously matter of control E, and that relates to conditions concerning operating procedures administered through water allocation committee. And in my supplementary evidence, and I'll just find the reference to make sure, at paragraph 30, I recognise that there is a number of informal flow sharing arrangements out in Otago, and we heard from Mr. Hickey yesterday about those, and that the priority is not the only issue, and that setting flow levels and sharing flows above those levels as part of the controlled activity rule may assist with preserving hydrology.
Just pause for a second.
Specific in relation to that. Are you going to go on to that in a minute or not?
I haven't got specific wording, but there is. But I can discuss it in a little more detail now, if you like.
I'm just getting to Mr. De Palsmaker's provisions. So this is the controlled activity rule. You were talking to?
Correct. The matters of control.
Matters of control. And the matter of control...
B, in relation to his 14
B.
March.
So you referred to paragraph 30 of your evidence.
Which is where I discuss it.
Yeah, which talks about matter E, but if it's matter B?
The footnote talks about B in the March 14 version. Sorry, I was trying to keep my mind straight on the version I was looking at, which was the notified version.
Okay, so just read out what your banner B is that you're addressing.
Yep.
Can you read the text to me?
I can.
Yep.
Any existing conditions concerning operating procedures administered through a water allocation committee that exists for the catchment.
All right, just pause for a second. Oh, any existing. I see. Okay, so what's your thinking on that?
I think there's an opportunity to expand this matter of control. As I understand it, water allocation committees are few and far between in Otago, but as we heard yesterday, there's potentially many informal, as in haven't been registered with the council in terms of an official committee, flow sharing groups. And I guess my view is there is an opportunity to recognise these informal arrangements in a more formal way through a matter of control and therefore a condition of consent. Now, there's a few things to consider. The flow sharing needs to occur above a level, so a flow level, whether it be a residual flow or otherwise, and that to maintain a simple controlled activity pathway, bringing these informal or currently informal flow sharing arrangements forward would have to be on a voluntary basis by the applicant rather than required by the council, because that would open up the matter of control considerably. It would require a level of work that wouldn't be consistent with a streamlined pathway.
I'm making a note. So it would open up the level of work required if it was compulsory considerably, because of for what reason?
Because if the work hadn't been done already, and I understand a lot of work has been done, but if the work had not been done, then it would require a consent applicant to propose a minimum flow, consult with all users of water on the water body, and form a flow sharing arrangement.
We, of course, have not seen any of these flow sharing agreements.
No.
And it may be that some are formally documented and are now applying as between permit holders on certain catchments, subcatchments, or certain water bodies, mainstems, and their tributaries. We don't know. It may be that they only apply contingent upon, will only apply on a voluntary basis, and their continuation is contingent upon securing, further resource consent or replacement consents on terms and conditions that are suitable to the consent holder. And again, we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
We're told these water flow sharing arrangements, the primary, an outcome, or a primary or principal outcome is that there is an environmental benefit. We don't know. But that's what we're told. So if this comes in, if this is a matter which is volunteered by an applicant or group of applicants, what sort of work do you think, if anything, what sort of inquiry or work, if anything, is to be done by the Regional Council, where it's conceivable that there will be variation across, the various water sharing arrangements? What's your thinking about that?
So in terms of, if I understand your question, in terms of determining whether the flow level and arrangement is appropriate. Yeah, I suspect that when looking at these, there needs to be a comparison of sorts against the status quo, and we heard yesterday that the status quo may be somewhat dynamic. So I think the information that would need to be presented would need to involve some level of baseline investigation as to what values are present, and recognising that this is probably not going to be the full suite of values anticipated through the NPSFM, but possibly more focused on ecological values. So a baseline by which a minimum flow and any flow sharing above that is sort of assessed. The In terms of looking at both priority and this flow sharing arrangement, in my view, it's to preserve as best we can the status quo, acknowledging that it might be dynamic, while further work is done for the future water and land plan. So it's holding the line, but in a slightly more adaptive way, given that potentially disrupting what is there now in a way that doesn't account for some of these values that might exist could potentially have a more detrimental outcome. And I acknowledge that there are some, you know, I say potentially because there are some unknowns as to how much priority is playing a role versus other mechanisms, but my view is that we should probably try and account for both at this stage.
So, insofar as the present environment is a product of flow sharing arrangements, or I'm not sure if it's an and or, I suspect it's just an or, priorities, so those two variables, they're not to disrupt the environment through not enabling those mechanisms to be brought forward, at least on a voluntary basis, is what you're recommending. So hold the environment to whatever mechanism is resulting in the current state of environment, be that a flow sharing agreement or be it priorities or possibly something else we've not been told. Is that where you're going?
Yes, that's right.
And if under that it turns out that flow sharing agreement is not providing for roundhead galaxids in central Otago, then it is not providing for roundhead galaxids in central Otago. If it turns out that was never an outcome or a controlling factor in a particular flow sharing agreement. Because to do otherwise would then to start to broaden out the scope and work effort, if I could put it that way,
yes,
of the controlled activity rule. Is that how you see it or something
it's,
else?
It's going to be a fine balance either way between getting enough information that the flow sharing arrangement, for example, is actually going to make things worse rather than better as
it's
proposed.
Not actually going to, or is going to make it worse or not, yeah.
Or not going to keep it as close to the status quo as.
Yeah, so you've lost me. What are you saying there?
So there's a fine balance between determining or requiring a high level of information that may not otherwise be available relatively easily, and missing out on the opportunity to maintain as close as possible to the status quo or not disrupt the ecology to the point where, instead of making incremental gains as anticipated, we're sliding backwards.
We're slightly backwards on this process. For the next six years.
Yeah. In the interim period, we're dealing with the life of Plan Change 7 or anticipated life of.
Is part of the problem for all parties, and then it follows for the court, that the current environment or the expression of the current environment is not well or is not known in relation to each mainstream water body and tributary. It may be an expression of flow sharing agreements, but these don't seem to have been in place for any length of time. According to Mr. Hickey yesterday, he said that they had only, there was a large volume of them being negotiated or being explored in the last 3 to 4 years. So maybe the current environment is an expression of that. Maybe it's an expression of the priorities interacting with other consent holders. In other water bodies with very few priorities, it would be an expression of something else altogether, wouldn't it?
Yes, I think that's right. Yeah. I mean, in terms of the level of information, I certainly wouldn't expect, I don't anticipate that I've got a full handle on the amount of information that isn't. I mean, more information was coming to light in Mr. Hickey's questioning yesterday, and hence the discussion or shift from just priorities to priorities and potential flow sharing arrangements being a contributing factor to this environment. And I think the risk is that if we focus just on one or just on the other, then we miss what we don't know. But I think you're right. It's the problem for everyone involved and the court that we have imperfect knowledge and are trying to make something as simple and streamlined as possible while dealing with that knowledge.
It is possible that within any catchment or subcatchment there will be some deemed permit holders that have held out and are not on those flow sharing agreements. Agree?
I suspect so.
So then what, in terms of them, then what would be the process for the council processing their applications as a controlled activity rule, which is that's the context of the discussion at the moment. What then?
I would suggest that the flow sharing arrangement only becomes an option if it's in place, so you don't have any holdouts, for example, in a catchment. Otherwise, we need to think about what the status quo is being driven by, and it possibly is priority. Or
yeah, and that's the problematic thing, isn't it? So you may, the flow sharing agreement may or may not include all deemed permit holders, and it may or may not also include everybody else who is a consent holder whose consents are coming up for replacement, or indeed who have got long-term consents. So it may include those people, may not. But if it doesn't, it doesn't therefore mean priorities, because priorities will be imposed for those people who are outside of the tent, because the current environment may or may not be an expression of that priority. Is that correct?
Well, as I understand it, the flow sharing agreements have been trialled, I guess, so there might be a relatively short-term expression, but I don't know this, but I would assume that if we were going to take that through into a controlled activity status and matter of control and formalise it, everyone would need to be in the tent for it to work. You can't have an abstractor halfway down the catchment that isn't playing the game and is taking out the water because the flow sharing agreement, the flow sharing will fall apart.
So I think, say that that is in fact the proposition, that the 90% are in the tent and 10% are out. What does the council do? Does the council just say, oh, well, we'll go with priorities? Does it, in fact, even need to go with priorities? If it goes with priorities, is not the risk then that there will be a new expression within the environment? Priorities will result in change the environment and consequential change in levels of effect being seen in the environment.
If they haven't been exercised in that catchment and some other arrangement, whether it be a temporary flow sharing trial, as was discussed, or something else, then there is a risk. Because you would be shifting to something that hasn't occurred.
So then how do you close off that risk?
I mean, in terms of the flow sharing part of it, I think unless everyone's in the tent, it won't apply. And in terms of the priority, I think we need to understand much better how much of a role priority might be playing in a catchment where there's been no discussion or informal flow sharing arrangement.
Okay.
I think we're missing some information there, possibly, to make a hard and fast call.
So that's something that the court needs to know before making a decision, or is that that information in terms of the exercise of priorities, or is that something that in terms of the information requirements for a resource consent application, it has to be addressed?
I think probably the court needs to understand the scope of that issue before making a decision, because it will have implications for the drafting of the rule and whether to just include priority and flow sharing agreements or to have another matter that deals with some in between, and whether there's, I haven't given too much thought to that, to be honest, but whether there's another mechanism that allows us to address that risk in a way that's certain enough to accompany a controlled activity rule.
Well, the evidence is there's no evidence. So then what are we to do? And the issue plays out in a forum where there is no evidence of any substantive sort by any party. So what are we to do?
Yeah, I'm not really sure. I mean, I think pushing it through to a resource consent process without some guidance around it is going to be problematic.
Yet, nevertheless, this is the environment that the court works in all the time, where there is an imperfect knowledge base. So are you indicating that further thinking needs to be done by yourself over this?
I think so.
Okay.
Yep.
So the Commissioner has a question.
Well, I want to ask a similar question in relation to these water flow sharing agreements. Would we need to know more about what they are, how they might work, where they might be working? What are the other implications? Is a possible implication that more water would end up being taken at various times than currently occurs? In terms of thinking about the holding the line and the status quo, and what that might that mean? Is that something else the court needs to know about?
I mean, it certainly needs to put its mind to it. As I understand from listening to Mr. Hickey yesterday, the flow sharing agreements or the arrangements are the purpose of them is to try and maintain a sort of a status quo, as it were, to maintain the values that have been identified from an ecological perspective through setting a flow limit. And so in terms of whether additional water is taken or not, there may be some fluctuations in how the water is taken, but the purpose of the limit would be to try and maintain those values or hold the line on those values. Now, that's just from listening yesterday. I haven't delved into the details of these agreements, and I'm not party to them, but the court certainly needs to put its mind to whether the flow arrangement on the face of it might be substandard, as administered by the agreement.
And is that something that you would need to think about too, and look into?
I think to shore up a final approach to this, as I said, I haven't given any thought to how it might be drafted and how it might fit together, and it's really just been on thinking over the evening. Previously, my thoughts had only really extended to priority. I think further thought would be necessary to try and incorporate the potential pitfalls, I suppose, of a flow sharing arrangement in a rule.
Right, and further evidence to what Mr. Hickey gave us yesterday.
Ideally, the content of some of those and the aims, and whether there is some certainty that can be provided to ultimately the council at the end of the day that that the flow sharing arrangement is, what is the objective of it in terms of holding the line, to use the well overused term now.
A line that's never really held. So
that's right.
With efficiency gains and so forth.
A slightly dynamic line, yes.
Yeah, it's what it is. I suppose the key thing being what is the outcome of the flow sharing agreement without necessarily, if these things are in place largely, without resulting in a disruption of those agreements. I think what is not clear is what is the outcome and whether that outcome will indeed hold the line, whatever that means, because I think it's a nonsense phrase where we see technological improvement which is permitted changing the environment in a way which is not visible to a regional council. I suppose the key thing is you don't know what the outcomes are. We're being asked to accept that the outcomes will be an environmental benefit, and assuming that is the case, though, it seems to me to be, it would not be appropriate for a controlled activity rule then to disrupt those outcomes. If a certain galaxid wasn't in the pot and should have been in the pot or in the mix, you wouldn't be wanting to reopen that stuff up and widen it out for...
No. I mean, I guess the purpose behind thinking about this more was that I recognised that priority was only one part of this.
Well, it is, yeah.
And
it may not be the controlling factor. It may not even be a factor at all.
That's right.
Mm.
And so how best to pick up, and I, as I've expressed, I don't actually have the answer at the moment, but how best to pull in what I heard to be potentially another reasonably tool. Significant contributing factor, potentially.
Yep, so it's another tool in the toolbox which
That's
has
right.
emerged through the course of the hearing. Is that tool to... For that tool to be applied, you would have to know what is the outcome of the tool, what is its objective. Is that there are likely to be multiple flow sharing agreements, many flow sharing agreements which are out there. And so the inclusion or use of that flow sharing agreement, or alternatively even priorities if flow sharing agreement doesn't exist, is that contingent on the outcome being whatever is meant by hold the line?
I think ideally.
Yeah.
I guess the other, this is a slightly more pessimistic way to look at it, is going backwards without anything in place. Priorities are uplifted or they're not being exercised. Mm. You're not left with anything.
You're not left with anything. Yeah.
You're just left with a 6-year
consent
with a rate of take on it.
Oh well. So in terms of the outcome, when looking at in exercising that matter of control, is that tied back to an outcome? Which outcome is the maintenance of the existing environment, including environmental flows. Is that what you're aiming at?
I think that's one way of sort of summing it up. Exactly what that looks like is here.
That would have to be in a policy?
I think that would assist.
That would assist
greatly.
All right. Anything else, or do you want to? Because this is kind of hard. Do you want to think about it and come back to and think about it some more? Because actually, this is kind of hard. I think all
yes,
parties.
Yes, I think it's the answer to that.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Okay.
Yep.
All right. Oh, well, I can take that up with Ms Dixon later. But anything else you want to say by way of summary, which we've totally distracted you from?
No, that's my summary.
That's it? Oh, that's concise. Thank you. Questions for cross-examination, and we're actually starting with you, Ms Lennon. Nope. We're starting with you, Mr Moore. Sorry.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Ensor.
Good afternoon.
I'm going to be working through what I think is the latest iteration of provisions that are attached to your supplementary statement of evidence. And I have some questions in relation to those suggestions. My first question, just for clarification, can you just confirm the underlying document that you tracked your changes into with respect to your Appendix B?
The notified version?
Notified
I
version.
I think.
Okay.
And just for ease of reference, do you have Mr. de Pelsmaker's 14 March amendments to hand as well?
To which version?
The 14 March, so the latest iteration, and it was the attachment 1, which had his tracked changes to, I'm going to say, the notified version.
I think that's to the 4th of March version.
4th of March version, let me just check. Amendments to the 4th of March version.
Yes, I have them to hand.
Excellent. So I want to start with your suggested amendments to policy 10A2.1. And I'd like to understand the changes made to subparagraph A, or your suggestions to subparagraph A, starting with the first part of that sentence. The proposed take is the direct replacement or otherwise reduces the volume of water. What is it that those two things seem to be two different things, and I'm just wanting to understand what it is you are trying to capture in relation to that paragraph.
The intention of that is that the water taken is either what is currently taken or is otherwise a reduction of that. There's no potential increase.
So, are you trying to capture what had been expressed in subparagraph E there, which you've struck out, that there's no reduction in the volume of water allocated? Sorry, that there is, it says there is a reduction.
That's correct. I suspect that having looked at Mr. de Pelsmaker's amendments and in the light of discussion with the court about the broadness or otherwise that striking out the matters of control what that might result in, I may not have turned my mind to readjusting this policy in as much detail to reflect those changes. So certainly the intention is that there is a that the replacement take is aligned with the intention of those matters as outlined. So a reduction, no increase in the water.
Right. So if you were to look at Mr. De Pelsmaker's wording, he's dealing with those two concepts. So the first concept being that it's a direct replacement. He deals with that in his subparagraph of A.
Correct.
And then in relation to the second component, he retains a subparagraph E that there is no increase in any actual volume of water taken.
Correct.
So those are the two things that you are responding to here, and you've jammed
yes,
them together,
that's right.
Possibly to try and tidy up the drafting. Do you accept that it may have an unintended consequence in terms of adding some confusion in terms of what is meant by the first part of that sentence in terms of mixing the two concepts?
Potentially, and the fact that you've raised the question probably highlights that there's enough confusion that it could be split.
And if you were to split out the second part there, so that otherwise reduces the volume of water taken, you'll see that Mr. De Pelsmaker has shifted away from requiring a reduction to ensuring that there's no increase in the actual amount of water taken. Do you agree that the emphasis should be on not allowing an increase?
The reason I included the option for a reduction is we shouldn't lock out the opportunity for a reduction. But I accept that the focus also should be on not increasing. But there shouldn't be the door shouldn't be shut to a reduction.
Yes, and when you read carefully Mr. De Pelsmaker's wording, it's no increase in the actual volume of water taken, as opposed to no reduction from the paper allocation. So in a sense, that that improvement is captured.
There is an improvement in terms of actual to from paper to actual. It doesn't specifically allow for anything beyond that if that was seen as desirable by someone, potentially unlikely, but...
Okay. Moving on, but staying in your subparagraph A, you've crossed out the deemed permit or water permit that is being replaced as a valid permit, and you have tried to capture in your wording immediately above that strikeout that the permit needs to be affected by the provisions of section 124 to 124C of the RMA. Now, when you undertook that exercise, what were you seeking to achieve by removing reference to the valid permit?
The intention was to wrap up this sort of valid permit concept and the fact that reference to section 124 was an expression of how the application would be progressing. So to make it clear that this was a valid permit that was progressing through a pathway.
Did you have in mind when you made that adjustment that the phrase valid permit had been defined within Chapter 10, Capital A?
Not specifically, no.
So if you pick up Mr. De Pelsmaker's version and track through to page 10 there, you'll see a definition of valid permit. And there you'll see that it's a little broader in terms of picking up some situations beyond simply where Section 124 is triggered.
Correct.
Have you turned your mind to the to those other situations, or had you not actually seen the definition when you were striking out the reference to valid permit?
I understand this definition has come through in the 4th of March version, and sort of back to my earlier point of, about this policy and perhaps not lining it up against the 4th of March version and considering it based on the notified version. I'd probably have to give a further consideration, but certainly wouldn't want to have an unintended consequence that one of those other matters ended up being critical.
So you're striking out of valid permit. You're actually seeking to provide some further guidance in what you'd added in.
Correct.
Because you just hadn't appreciated there was a further definition providing that clarity.
Correct.
I want to track down now to subparagraph B. So we're still in policy 10A2.1. And there you've struck out that there is no increase in the area under irrigation if the abstracted water is used for irrigation. Now, you mentioned a moment or two ago that you may need to make some further adjustments in light of the controlled activity rule as you now recommend. So I just want to understand that I've read your version of the controlled activity rule correctly. So my understanding of your version of the CA rule is that there is to be no increase in the area of land under irrigation. And that's picked up in your rule 10A 3.1.1 Roman 3.
Correct.
So that rule, in the absence of any policy direction, would be an orphan rule without policy guidance?
Somewhat, yes.
So isn't it better to keep that requirement in to the policy?
Yes, I think it would be.
And moving on to paragraph C, there's no increase in the instantaneous rate of abstraction. Same logic applies.
I think it does, yep.
And in relation to subparagraph D, the existing condition, existing flow conditions.
That could probably remain too. Unless, in reality, the intention was that component might be picked up by the wording of direct replacement. But going back to your point about some potential confusion there, I think we should avoid it if possible.
I want to move on now to understanding your evidence in relation to the controlled activity pathway. And I want to start this exercise by looking at your evidence in chief. I can take you to your paragraph 55 to start with.
Just pause there a second.
Yeah, 55. And in your paragraph 55, you're reflecting on the notified version of Plan Change 7, and you observe that there's a need to make the either the controlled or the restricted discretionary pathway more attractive, and entry to the non-complying activity rule needs to be more stringent.
Correct.
And then in your evidence you go on to consider in a little more detail the non-complying activity rule, and you consider that there needs to be some changes made in relation to recognising water takes for drinking water and water takes for hydroelectricity generation. And you capture then in your paragraph 68 that the amendments that you proposed to policy 10A23 are necessary to implement the change in focus. Just want to make sure I've understood what you meant when you referred to a change in focus in that paragraph. Were you referring to the need to somehow accommodate drinking water and hydroelectricity generation, but otherwise make the pathway more stringent, or was it something else?
In relation to providing a pathway for drinking water and hydroelectricity generation as per the supplementary evidence and otherwise making it more stringent.
Right. So philosophically, what you're trying to achieve with your drafting is a pathway through the controlled activity rule to facilitate longer-term consenting for drinking water and hydroelectricity, but otherwise making it more stringent for other activities.
Yes, and the drafting provides access to up to 35 years for drinking water or hydro, and to 2035 for others, provided they meet the more stringent tests.
And it's in relation to those others that I wish to explore with you the implications of your drafting, because you've broadened the rule and the policy to provide a pathway for others outside of those two categories, haven't you?
Not in terms of from the notified version, where there was the minor test, which didn't restrict there was no restriction on use. So I think it's the same activities are open to try their luck.
Right. I'd like to explore with you then. So you've proposed some wording to policy 10A 2.3 to address your change of focus. And I want to start with you by making sure that I've understood how your drafting is intended to operate. And I want to start with the chapeau to the policy. So that is around establishing that replacement permits should not be granted for more than 6 years, and I'm paraphrasing there, except in the circumstances that are outlined in the subparagraphs that follow.
Correct.
So in a sense, the exception to the rule of 6 year permits. And if we look at subparagraph A, if a consent applicant is seeking to renew a permit that has an existing residual flow, minimum flow, or take cessation condition, and it could be any of those three, or one of those three.
If they have one of those three on the existing permit.
So staying with that situation, subparagraph B wouldn't apply, or subparagraph B would apply.
Subparagraph B, the intention is that subparagraph B would apply in a situation where an existing minimum flow has not been included on the permit, but that one has been set elsewhere. So
sticking with subparagraph A, if the permit being replaced did have a minimum flow condition on it, subparagraph B wouldn't apply?
Correct.
Put that again. I'm following this closely. So if...
If a permit had a minimum flow...
It did have a minimum flow.
So it did have...
Yep, did, yep.
Then subparagraph B wouldn't apply?
Correct.
And subparagraph C wouldn't apply either?
No, because there'd be a minimum flow in place.
And subparagraph D, which is further down the page, would apply. So it's essentially a 15-year permit.
Correct.
So when we think about that, the consequence is that for any consent holder who has a minimum flow on a permit can renew that permit for a 15-year period.
Correct.
And that was what you were intending to achieve through your drafting?
The intention through the drafting was to make sure that values were protected somewhat through either a residual flow, minimum flow, or take cessation. I guess the challenge is that the minimum flow, and I suspect this is where your question is heading, is that the minimum flow may not necessarily be appropriate in a long term. And that, I guess, and long term in this case being 15 years or to 2035.
So when you were thinking about this, did you, or whose evidence have you relied upon in terms of the nature of the existing minimum flows and what it might mean for those to be rolled over for a 15-year period?
None, because the intention would be that the minimum flows were potentially looked at in the light of the matters in C, I through V.
But those don't apply in this situation, do they?
No, I acknowledge they don't.
So I'm just trying to understand in the first instance what your intention was and whether your intention's been reflected in the drafting. So is it that you're of the opinion that the matters you've set out in subparagraph C ought to be considered in relation to every application for a non-complying activity?
Yes, I think that's a fair summation. And the drafting at this stage doesn't necessarily reflect that.
Just want to track through then, just understanding your intention in relation to existing residual flow or a take cessation condition. So staying with subparagraph A as well, was it your intention that subparagraphs either B or C should also be considered in relation to applications where the underlying permit has either of those types of conditions?
I would say, in terms of B, with the where existing minimum flows have been included in the schedule, the intention was that they would carry through to a line on a water body, the minimum flow requirements, rather than doing this, setting minimum flows in a what would otherwise be an ad hoc way. So if you've got existing permits with Schedule 2A minimum flows on their consent, my intention was that they would, that other takes on that water body would line up.
So let's stay with subparagraph B for a moment. So this, just so I've understood this correctly, where there's no existing minimum flow, but there has been one set in Schedule 2A, that minimum flow would be applied on the replacement permit?
Correct.
And that permit would apply then, or be in place for a 15-year period?
Correct.
And were the matters in your subparagraph C to be considered in addition, or was B intended to be standalone?
It was intended to be standalone for the reasons mentioned before, to try and align minimum flows on a water body to avoid a mismatch, I suppose.
So the effect of that occurring would be to lock in place the flow regime set out in Schedule 2A for a 15-year period?
It would already be locked in, as I understand it, if there is already takes with a 2A minimum flow on them to an extent. And in terms of looking at a future land and water plan approach, a holistic catchment-wide or water body-wide approach would need to somehow be taken, presumably through a review.
We'll come back to reviews a little later on, but in relation to these Schedule 2A limits, are you, or do you have any knowledge as to the basis on which those limits were set?
No, not a detailed knowledge at all.
So whose evidence are you relying on as to the appropriateness of those flows for the next 15-year period?
So my proposition is that where these flows are already in place, that for the purposes of aligning the permits in that catchment, that the 2A minimum flows should be applied. So as opposed to what might be a specific environmental outcome being considered beyond what was considered at the time that those were set.
Might that not have the effect of depriving the council the ability to implement its new land and water plan in a timely fashion?
Where there are already permit holders with a minimum flow on their consent, my view is it wouldn't change things much. There's going to have to be a process by which to bring existing permit holders with minimum flows into line, and this would, in the round, be addressed at the same time.
I think I'm now a little bit confused about what your subparagraph B is relating to, because it says here where an existing minimum flow has not been included on a consent being replaced. So are you talking about situations where permit holders do already have the Schedule 2A limits or something else?
Not the permit holder making their application under this policy, but other permit holders on the water body who may have a minimum flow, a Schedule 2A minimum flow on their permit.
So in essence, you're seeking to ensure that the Schedule 2A flow regime is locked in place for that 15-year period, or earlier if the council undertakes a review?
Not ensuring to. It's to align the permits on a water body where, as I understand it, some permits may have a Schedule 2A minimum flow and some may not, and it's to align those.
might your purpose be equally achieved by having that as an option for a six-year permit?
Potentially, given the in light of the controlled activity, the intention of the controlled activity rule to be streamlined, if the existing work had already been done in this case, the minimum flows in Schedule 2, then there's it could be included under that regime without without opening up the control unnecessarily.
And that's notwithstanding whether the limits in Schedule 2A are actually appropriate, because you
that's can't right.
Give us any further evidence on that. Right, so if an application gets through subparagraph B, then C doesn't apply. That was correct?
Correct.
So as I understand it, C is triggered where a 15-year permit is sought outside of a Schedule 2A catchment?
Correct.
And is it fair to say that what you've sought to capture in your subparagraph C is the NPS FM 2020?
Components of that, for sure, with some guidance from the RPS direction on a couple of matters.
It's a difficult task to try and distill the NPS into a subparagraph and a policy and a plan.
I'd agree.
But you've attempted to do so, and I just want to tease out with you just what you mean and how this might be applied in practice. So let's say we have one of these applications that has been lodged. Staying in the chapeau of subparagraph C, there's a requirement to maintain a residual flow in the surface water body downstream of the abstraction that first and foremost prioritises the health and well-being of the water body and freshwater ecosystems. Now that's a very big task, isn't it?
I suspect so, yes.
And that task is informed through, if you think about the NPS, the NPS has a whole lot of machinery in it to tease out what that actually means in a particular FMU.
Correct.
And when you think about the health and well-being of a water body, it's not just ecological considerations?
No, there's wider considerations.
And the community has a significant role to play in terms of articulating the level at which or the way in which the well-being of a water body is to be recognised?
Through that NPS FM process, yes. Yes.
There are some significant cultural implications and input required to understand that first priority?
Correct, in the context of the full implementation of the NPS FM.
So how is it that an individual consent holder undertakes that task?
I mean, my view is that this process described here is not attempting to pull forward the full implementation of the NPS FM. It is, as far as reasonably practicable, in the context of an interim plan change with the view that the Part 3 machinery rolls on for the fresh the water and land plan, that there is a that there is some level of regard is had to that the priority in Te Mana o Te Wai, and that when advancing an application that this isn't that the health and well-being of water bodies and freshwater ecosystems isn't parked for that future process, but in part is at least a key consideration for an application under this policy.
Isn't there a danger in picking and choosing parts of the NPS in a situation where 15-year permits could well be granted in response?
Explain what you mean, sorry, by picking and choosing.
Well, your subparagraph C doesn't capture the full suite of requirements from the NPS.
No, but it focuses on a reasonably core component of the objective and picks up another matter.
So might that not deprive the council from the opportunity to properly address all of the matters in the NPS in its new land and water plan and to implement it in a timely manner?
I think in any situation where there is going to be a resource consent granted for a duration beyond the new land and water plan coming into force has that potential. The intention here is that if there is a true exception identified or an exception identified that has done a level of work, acknowledging it's not the Part 3 process of under the NPS, but a level of work that that any implications of that are minimised.
Isn't the better option to simply leave the NPS for consideration under Section 104(1)(b) in the context of a non-complying activity?
I guess the challenge with that is is the lack of guidance or certainty around its application at a consent level.
And that is exactly the problem that is presented by 15-year permits, isn't it? There needs to be some time to understand and to put in place the regime.
Sorry, say that again. The 15-year permits, sorry.
Isn't the effect of you picking and choosing some elements of the NPS and saying or highlighting to people that they can get a 15-year permit if they do some of those things, it essentially puts to one side the other elements of the NPS for that period of time?
I think what it does is it recognises that there are potentially situations where where permits may need to be granted or it might be appropriate to grant them, and provides more guidance around that process as opposed to just referring to 104 as a 104 matter. So as I said before, granting any permits beyond the water and land plan, the vehicle for full implementation of the NPSFM does pose some level of risk. The intention is that the strengthening of the policy will mean that the number of permits in that category are relatively small.
might it in fact be the other way round, and that applicants see this and say, I can get a 15-year permit if I do those things, and there's sufficient uncertainty about what some of those things mean at the moment, it might make the pathway more attractive.
I mean, in relation to... No, I don't think I completely agree. I think there is a level of... there's going to be a level of information required to accompany an application that meets those requirements that will be a... it'll be a reasonable undertaking and probably not taken lightly.
Except that there is a risk that it could be seen that way?
I wouldn't like to answer for others, but potentially.
I want to drill down to sub paragraph C, Roman 2. Enhances life-supporting capacity of aquatic ecosystems. What's that in comparison to? So how much enhancement is required?
That would be an enhancement in relation to the status quo.
So an applicant would just need to do a little bit better to tick that box.
Alongside the other matters, yes.
Well, let's look at the next matter, enhancing natural character. So just a little bit better than status quo.
Read on its own, yes.
And then on to Roman 4, enhancing spiritual and cultural values, just a little bit more.
He's on its own, yeah.
Isn't the danger here that without the community having established its long-term vision and values and the land and water plan articulating attribute states, there's no understanding as to the level at which improvement or enhancement needs to get to under the NPS. So there's no frame of reference in the absence of that information.
Yes, the frame of reference, I guess, is the current environment for the most part. Mm.
I want to move one line down to your Roman 5. And this is where you say, protects the ability of existing water abstractors and water abstractors affected by the provisions of section 124 to 124C of the RMA to undertake lawfully established activities. Now, when I read that paragraph, I understand that this policy is seeking to protect lawfully existing, lawfully established activities. So what do you mean when you say a lawfully established activity? What is it that is driving to?
So consented or permitted activities.
So a deemed permit, for example, in this context, would be the lawfully established activity?
Correct.
And in order to protect that activity, might you see an applicant saying, well, to protect that, I need to get given precisely what I've been given in the past, and 15 years, thank you very much.
The intention of that clause is for it to apply to other existing lawfully established activities on a water body, with the focus on preserving priority where it might assist in preserving hydrology.
And so there are some significant challenges associated with your drafting in terms of how you've tried to express that concept?
I think an insertion of other after of might help.
Insertion of what, sorry? Of other.
Ability of other existing water abstractors.
So this policy doesn't apply to deemed permits or applications to replace existing permits. It applies to something else?
The intention is that it's recognising that by taking into consideration impacts on other water users, by maintaining priority, essentially, where that exists, that there may be a consequential benefit for maintaining hydrology and therefore any values associated with that regime. That was the intention.
I'll just pause there a second and make a note of that. So without looking at the language, could you say again what your... how this policy is implementing an objective? Don't even look at the language. Where were you going with this?
That when residual flows are set, that consideration is had for the role priority plays or may play in a water body in terms of the hydrology and associated values that have adapted to that environment.
So this is like the RDA matter of discretion that Mr. Page referred to earlier, at least in part, looking at the impact of a proposal on another water user.
Correct.
With
the express aim of preserving the hydrology status quo is if it exists through priority.
I don't read that. In fact, we've actually got some grave concerns about what we see here in that provision for a whole host of reasons, but I didn't get that out of there. So that's useful.
Yes.
You can press into those grave concerns if you like, but or if you have them.
I do have them, but it strikes me that the witnesses meant something quite different to what's been written on the page, and I'm not sure whether it actually will assist me taking through the implications of precisely what the drafting of this provision, the implications that might have.
Yeah. Well, it might not. If it is to do with looking at other users, the impact of a proposal on another abstractor and the impact of the same proposal on other ecosystem values, then that drafting wouldn't get you there. It doesn't really reflect that.
I'm conscious that it's 1 o'clock.
You want a break?
I may just reflect on that. Now,
okay.
And I should perhaps signal, I know my friend's going to tell me we have some timing challenges with this witness, potentially.
No, he's catching a later plane. Yeah, he's catching a later plane.
There we go. I should signal I've got a little way to go.
And I'll allow it. The witnesses, I will allow an extension to your cross-examination. I think you're well over your estimate, but this is too important. The 124 concern that we've got, you know, Commissioner, do you want to express it? It's a concern generally as to how Section 124 applications are being used around the country to file for renewals and then put on hold because, you know, we've got, you know, the applications to renew existing consent are a bare proposal, which oddly are receipted in by council rather than chopping somebody off and rejecting these application. And then... and then the process. And then the process begins. Information requests after information request after information request.
And years later, nothing is decided.
Yeah. So that's a general problem with the operation of 124, and we're looking at this going, oh, that invites that sort of outcome. Yeah.
Yes.
So for context, that was our concern. I don't know whether you've heard of that yourself.
It's probably a slightly cynical view, but I'm sure it does
cynical
happen in terms of being
born
engineered that way. But cynical approach to doing it. But I can see why that might be a concern. Inviting it. Arguably, the application should not be.
Yeah. Place in the queue and you build from there.
Yeah, yeah.
That's how
while you continue exercising
right. Yes. Yeah.
What you've already got.
Yeah, okay. So just to let you know, that was our concern with this wording, but I don't think that where Mr. Enzel wishes to go is what's actually described in the provision anyway.
No, and that's the fundamental concern with testing the wording in this. Yep. Here at present, I may talk to my friend over lunch about whether leave that with me. I'll.
I don't want to know.
No.
Okay, very good.
You don't ask it, we
will. Yes.
Right, I'll let you. We'll take an adjournment. Did you need to say something?
There is one more thing that I just wanted to alert you to. Mr. Winchester is taking my place at some point this afternoon, and there may be a short interval when neither one of us are here. Okay. Should be relatively short, though.
Okay, very good. So Mr. Winchester's subbing.
Yes.
Yep. Very good. All right, thank you.
All rise.